Welcome to We Do, the officially unofficial podcast for Watchmen on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 6, This Extraordinary Being. Aaron, second watch, what do you think?
I really liked it. I had a couple of things that I thought were weird and strange, even above and beyond Watchmen standards. On the Instant Talk podcast, I mentioned how I thought it was odd that in a show that has not sensationalized the sensational stuff that black people have gone through in this country, like, the Wall Street attack, the Black Wall Street attack, rather. It was odd to me that they chose to add this kind of like mystical sci-fi black conspiracy on black people as that's weird. You can't find like some kind of real life forms of oppression and whatnot. And I read a lot, and there's a couple of articles I thought were especially enlightening on some of this, and they were written, no coincidence, by two black women. One is Joelle Monique for the AV Club. The article is titled "Watchmen Embraces Its Noir Roots and Black Trauma," and another one by Soraya McDonald, This Extraordinary Being article that she wrote for The Undefeated. I'll link both of those in the comments, but it's this theme of that, how the media can be used against people, how it can shade other people's perceptions of themselves, and how it can be, negative depictions and whatnot can give you this negative self image. And they also drew, both of those ladies in particular, drew this parallel between, I don't know if you've seen this, Alan Moore interview has been kicking around the last few weeks from 2016, where as Alan Moore frequently does, took to this interview to kind of shit on his previous works and adaptations thereof. And he mentioned that people didn't, he's bemoaning the fact that like adults are so fixated on comic books. Mm-hmm. Because, in his mind, there's like this like vast, insidious kind of racist history of comic books. And he mentioned that like in his mind, the first superhero movie was Birth of a Nation. That like racist Klan apologia that was made because, here's these costume heroes going forth and fighting evil.
Yeah.
And these ladies, these women took that kind of and ran with it and talked about, black depiction in media and how that kind of ties into the Cyclops using films to, spark a bunch of unrest and distrust within the community. And I thought that was just some really smart takes and kind of resolved. It still, I think, is weird that, it'd be kind of like if there was flying saucers at the Wall, the attack on Black Wall Street, the attack on Greenwood.
Yeah.
But I kind of think I see more where Lindelof is going with it. It wasn't just kind of like what the fuck. Where there's still a lot of other what the fuck where I don't understand. Like I still understand why Will had to have a relationship with this girl he saved. How that tied, like what the nature of their relationship was and that stuff that is strange, but shit, real life gets weird sometimes.
Yeah. Stranger things have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a series about it on Netflix, Upside Down and Psychic Kids. It's crazy.
I think this episode also feels maybe the most like a comic book of any of the episodes yet. I don't know why. I'm trying to think why. Maybe because
it's an origin story.
Watchmen has this noir vibe to it, and I think like the black and white filter on this thing and sort of the period setting and everything made me like put me in that headspace throughout the episode. And also like a lot of the transitions are very like old movie, but also comic book panel-y type things.
Yeah.
So I was really getting on second watch, a strong comic book vibe from this episode.
I didn't think about that, but you're like one of the most iconic parts of any superhero series of anything really is their origin story.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like the second half of his origin story. I the official podcast is just interesting this week because like a lot of the stuff they talk about is kind of things that we've figured out. So they talked about a couple of things that I thought were interesting, which one of them was Will Reeves. He mentioned that, Lindelof was talking about how obviously there's a lot of Superman inspiration, which we've talked about, his escaping this destroyed home world and as an infant, and he's phenomenally strong and they activated around the same time, Superman and Will Reeves in 1939 or 38. Mm-hmm. But he also said that there's a lot of parallels to Batman, and the Batman is an example of like a two-stage hero ignition that that like he was traumatized as a child by his family being murdered, and that left him with a lifelong quest for justice. But he never knew how quite to fight that fight until he was traumatized a second time as an adult. After he got his ass kicked on his first foray into crime fighting, and then he was scared by these bats, and he realized, I can use this fear against the same fear I feel against the criminal underworld. And here Will, obviously traumatized by what he saw in Greenwood, then when he becomes a cop and he gets lynched by his fellow officers, coming home and realizing he can use this rage and this anger inside of him to fight against his enemies. I thought that was a pretty insightful point. But
yeah, makes a lot of sense.
The other thing is Lindelof promised in his podcast that we were going to get answers to a few bullet points, which I thought was impressive. He said that we're going to definitely get answers to what's going on with Ozymandias and his prison. They will illuminate what Lady True's plan is and how the clock fits in and how Angela fits into large. I'm like, that's like everything. I mean, that's a lot of that's if.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like if I was going to ask, what are the questions on the board that we need to know? He's promising answers by the finale. So I'm pretty excited.
Right? You have to. I mean, this is planned as a one-shot season.
Yeah.
If you don't answer any of those three major questions, right, you don't have a complete show.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, you him maybe promising need this episodes, is like the asshole. Easiest promise ever.
Sure.
Right? It's like me promising that one way or another, I'm going to go to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
Or one way or another, I will not live forever. Like, is that a promise I can't keep?
It would be hilarious if you died in traffic because you would simultaneously never sleep again, always be sleeping again, and also not be immortal. It's like,
oh, is this a tricky answer by him? Is he going to answer by not answering somehow?
No, he's going to answer by having his Tesla drive him into traffic, and because they're still shooting it.
You never use summon when you're in the vehicle. Come on. It breaks the logic. It doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I thought that was, pretty, I feel good. I feel good about relaxing, kind of enjoying this because in Lindelof's mind, he thinks he's answered it. And also the other thing that's super interesting about Lindelof is he's like one of the few people that cops to like, oh yeah, I read everything. Uh-huh. Like I can't help it. Like he calls himself a recap culture junkie. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I can't, I'm on I'm on these sites and I'm reading about all the other stuff that I'm interested in. And like, what am I going to do? Ignore these headlines talking about my own show? And
yeah,
I like that he's like unapologetic about just like bathing in that shit, good, bad, and indifferent. Relatable. He's a relatable guy.
Absolutely.
Do we have anything else we want to do like in the...
I don't think so.
Preamble?
I got some stuff on the PDpedia, but we traditionally do that at the end of the show.
Yeah.
So let's just get right into the recap.
All right. One thing I want to talk about is the episode title itself, This Extraordinary Being. I remember when I was a couple weeks ago, someone was making a theory based on like episode titles. I was trying to decide whether it was a spoiler or not, and I saw that this episode was called This Extraordinary Being, and I kind of mentally drew a circle on my calendar and said, this is going to be the episode where Dr. Manhattan shows up.
The All Mars episode.
Yeah. And it turns out that Manhattan's not extraordinary enough. It's actually about the life and times of this Will Reeves, which makes sense now that I've seen it. But
housekeeping.
Our annual holiday-type shenanigans start next week. Be on the lookout for a little trailer we've cooked up. Pickle Me This is our Rick and Morty podcast for season 4, and on this episode, Rick hates heist movies so much he spends an entire 30 minutes subverting the whole genre. Find out what Jim and I have to say on Pickle Me This. Over on Bald Move TV, Alexis and Cecily are covering His Dark Materials, aka that one HBO show where the scary lady has a monkey that's constructed entirely out of deep shame and red fur. Also, we talked The Mandalorian and Rick and Morty with Gustavo Cerola from Rooster Teeth. Check that out. Over on Bald Movies, in case you missed it, we saw A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood last week, the quasi-Mr. Rogers biopic that had us wondering if you could found a secular religion around the life of Fred Rogers. The answer is almost certainly, and that he would hate it. Pretty good argument against doing it, I guess. If you've enjoyed my occasional political tangents here on Bald Move, or maybe especially if you haven't, you might try listening to my new podcast on the Swizzbold Network, Three Right Turns. This week's episode is entitled Star Trek Republican, and I mean, that title doesn't intrigue you. I don't know. I also make jet noises with my mouth, so check that out. If any of these sound good, you can find out more information on baldmove.com to subscribe or search for the show name wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, let's get into the recap. We kind of start off with a title card here that turns from Watchmen into Minutemen with a little puff of smoke. And then we go right into the American Hero story, where two FBI agents are talking with Hooded Justice. Turns out Captain Metropolis is blackmailing Hoover with a film of them getting it on. The FBI wants to get a picture of
that's
Hooded
a Hoover
Justice.
Lookalike. That's some un-American talk right. I'm hearing from your mouth, Jim.
Right, because he's definitely not a homosexual.
He would not be a degenerate, this Edgar Hoover.
Their words, not ours. So the FBI, it's a weird play here. They want Hooded Justice to voluntarily give them a picture of himself that they can use to blackmail him into getting the tape from Captain Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
So they can destroy it, put it in a file for later, whatever they do with those tapes.
Yeah.
It's a strange play asking the blackmail victim to give you the blackmail material.
Yeah, I think it's more of like I didn't get that they were going to force Captain Metropolis into giving his... It's more of like a mutual assured destruction. Like, surely you won't want this to get out about you, the fact that you're a homosexual. So give us a picture of your face and then, you know, we'll have assurance that you're never going to, like, run your mouth or something. Did they actually say that they were going to use that to force Captain Metropolis into...
You mean Hooded Justice? I'm very confused here.
So... I thought what you said was that they were going to take Hooded Justice picture to force Captain Metropolis into giving up his insurance against Hoover, which is a film of them having sex.
No, they're taking Hooded Justice's picture to force Hooded Justice, under threat of releasing his photo, I assume, and revealing his secret identity, to go get the tape from Captain Metropolis.
Oh, so he's just going to go and beat Captain Metropolis up for his tape, and it'll be the only tape in existence?
I mean,
because
I assume so,
you can't ever make a duplicate of tape, and
harder to make a duplicate back then.
1950, but... fucking whatever it was. I just didn't interpret that way. I thought it was just more of like, hey, we want to make sure since you got some on us, we got some on you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
To kind of save and I mean, the FBI used to keep files on like all kinds of people. Hoover's a nut job.
I've seen
not because
seen
he liked
Leo's.
To wear women's clothing and he might have been gay. He's just a nut job. He's a paranoid freak.
Yeah.
So
Hooded Justice does take off his hood, but then he kills the only two people who've seen him.
And he reveals a very handsome Cheyenne Jackson, which, as I mentioned on an Instant Take podcast, made me very happy as an American Horror Story fan because this is the culmination of the. Would you say it's a Ryan Murphy love fest? I mean, to me, this cements it as a love fest. Like, Cheyenne Jackson wouldn't be on something that's shitting all over Murphy. This is just like, this is the kind of shit that Murphy would do if he lived in this universe instead of the one he does.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that we start this episode off with this sort of salacious scene about sex stuff, right?
Yeah, the sex stuff.
With the classic routine, bad cop, sex cop.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you've seen it in all the noirs.
Bad cop, worse cop.
Right. But it frames sort of Hooded Justice as like, this deviant sexual miscreant, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in actuality, like the things that he was fighting for were so much more important, so much more interesting. And like you get the feeling that Captain Metropolis by the end of this episode is almost the same sort of like negligent superhero that these FBI agents are, right? They're not doing anything for the good of humanity. They're just doing things to cover their own asses.
Sure.
They're doing things for their own profit in the case of Metropolis, it seems. Mm-hmm. Like, your own image.
Advance their own causes, for sure.
Yeah, so it kind of sets up this false narrative right at the beginning, which I like, because the rest of the episode proceeds to subvert that, which is really cool.
I really like just from camera technique, there was a lot of flashy stuff going on here, but the whole point of view camera punch of the guy and then, you know, smashing the skulls together and saying cheese finally. I just thought that was and pretty good stunt work by
but it's
by
supposed
Mr. Jackson.
To be cheesy, right? Like, this is Hero story.
Oh yeah.
So like, it's just a little bit of an indulgence.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's cheesy.
It's of a piece. If, like I said, Seth and I talked all the episodes of the 1984 season 9 of American Horror Story, and it's of a piece. Mm-hmm. It's nice and pulpy and fun.
Then we come back to reality, though we're not going to stay there very long. Lori tries to get Angela to sign a release to have her stomach pumped before she goes into a nostalgia-induced coma. She's too late, though, and Angela begins to experience Will's memories. And I found it interesting. We know everybody is watching American Hero Story, but it seems like everybody knows Angela's identity anyway. I can't tell if they found out because Angela's dressed up as Sister Knight, right?
Right.
And when you go to the precinct, everybody's asking how Angela is.
Yes.
So like, yes, they're supposed to keep their shit on during when they're in the precinct, but also everybody knows everybody's identities. Like, this doesn't seem like a very secretive society.
I guess you're right that if the masks, I didn't pick this up, but I guess lifting your mask to each other in the precinct is kind of a sign of trust and respect, because presumably the only one who knows all their identities was Judd, because he's the one that goes around without his face. It's probably part of the whole deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I guess if they practice their privacy perfectly, they did the three P's, that none of them would know who each other is, and that would be a vital part of the, because if you capture one of them and then you torture them and you give
them, can't give up anybody else.
Yeah, but
it's compartmentalization.
Yeah, so the fact that Looking Glass and Angela would like reveal their faces to each other is maybe a sign that we're closer than, because I don't think I've seen the Red Scare or Pirate Ginny ever do that.
Yeah, I think
maybe you're, and it seems like, if you have to wear the mask inside the precinct, then it's not just because maybe some random journalist or criminal would see you, but like also, it compartmentalizes things.
Yeah, they seem to not take it very seriously, though.
Well, I also wonder if like the jig's kind of up, you know, once you took the nostalgia, and one of the things we learned in
PDP, and got arrested, and
one of the things we learned in the PDPedia, which we'll talk about more later, is that like Angela ran her mouth the entire time, the hours,
I don't understand.
They make it seem like everything that Will Reeves said in the dream world, Angela was speaking out loud.
Well,
and
she was narrating like the whole damn thing. Like, it's weird. We'll talk about
it. I wonder if she's narrating, like, because she, that's funny.
And then he pointed the mesmerizer like at Judd Crawford.
A real noir detective.
Exactly.
I walked into this
she had to be
clam
some
joint
of the...
and it stank of cabbage and beer. and
racism.
Yeah. And burnt Jewish delicatessen. She's like giving all this. That'd be really funny if it was like. Because
she had to be with some of these details that they're gleaning from this conversation.
This blended in from the PO, the officers are watching the American Hero Story, and Cheyenne Jackson was in the middle of this lurid, you know, it's like, I probably should have thought about assaulting two federal agents, but all I could think about is that Nielsen cheating on me. And like, so it's like, that would be funny if she was doing that the whole time. Yeah. Oh my God.
She had to be.
But yeah, she not only heard all that, but she recorded it too. So everything that Angela found out about herself, in universe, Lori found out about Angela.
Right.
So that will be interesting in episodes to come, I'm sure.
In this scene, they also tell us a lot of stuff we already knew from the PD files about nostalgia as a drug. You're never supposed to take anybody else's. There's such a thing as overdosing, all this kind of stuff.
I think that's perfect because it informs people's speculation. It gets people's juices and flowing for the episode. And then they confirm it right away for the people, like most of the sane world, that doesn't go around reading HBO's fan fiction about its fake universe, you know?
Yeah, they very much are keeping the people reading the PDpedia one step ahead of the show.
Yeah.
Just basically giving us a preview for what's going to happen next week.
But it's tough because I've seen where that stuff is completely irrelevant to a show, and I've seen where that stuff gives too much away. And like, this is like, whoever's doing it, I wonder if this is actually out of the writer's room. Like, this doesn't feel like shit that they just trusted to some PR guy to just like, come up with some colorful background.
Yeah, Lindelof
background.
Says in the podcast this
week. Oh, did he? Okay.
That it's absolutely them writing it.
Okay. Because I would even believe it's actually Lindelof himself. Like, you know, that might be fun as for writers to try on all these because he gets to write a gossip mag.
Right.
Gets to write a memo from Petey's perspective, one from Lori's perspective.
He gets to write a will.
He gets to do all this crazy stuff that really kind of underlines the stuff he's trying to do in the episodes.
Yeah. Then we go to 1938, New York City Police Department cadet graduation ceremony. Everyone is honored by the white chief pinning their badge on them, except for Will, who has his badge pinned on by the only black officer in the ranks. And the guy tells him to beware the Cyclops.
Did you ever think, because that's one of the things we had a question about in the instant take, is how the use of color was used in this show, because I think that it's used a lot like Spielberg did in Schindler's List, which is to underline some kind of emotional moment or something. It didn't seem like it had a rhyme or like, oh, this is stuff that's reminding him of Tulsa versus this is, I don't know. Did you crack the code or feel like you had a better handle on it?
I mean, I came away from the second viewing still thinking it reminded him of Tulsa.
Why was he the only, why was he the only colored officer that was also depicted in color, though? Because
I didn't notice that.
That's more of him just isolating his isolation, you know, like drawing attention to literally he's the only black officer until you see the other black officers, which I don't know if you noticed this, but the Samuel Battle, not only did he have a badass name, but he's actually real life New York City's first black police officer.
Yeah, so I read.
Yeah, so that was cool. Continuing honoring people like Bass Reeves and Samuel Battle.
He's got an awesome name, too.
They all do. Like Bass Reeves, yeah. Samuel Battle? What the fuck? Like, that's like...
That's a name you can be proud of.
Yeah, it's like that's like one of the alter egos of He-Man's, retinue. You know, Samuel Battle, okay. He turns into the ass ripper or something. I don't know.
Wow. Wow. Okay. What is this, American Hero Story? All right.
Yeah, you know what? I meant, actually, my mental image was like grabbing like an ass and ripping someone in half like a phone book, but it's also unfortunate that I chose that knowing that Will is bisexual or gay and really gives it to Captain Manhattan. Captain Metropolis, rather.
So, yeah. Just...
I apologize. I was going for the ripping in half the phone book.
You were trying to conjure the ghostly images.
Literally destruction of a man, not sexually. Right. Right.
Okay, let's please
move
on.
Not that there's anything wrong with sexually destroying another man.
We're going to move on now. Okay. Will takes his wife to a jazz club, a wholesome, non-ass-ripping jazz club.
No one's ass is being ripped in this classy establishment.
Absolutely not. He thinks that she's worried about his safety and his racial integrity after joining the police force, but she's really more worried about how angry he is and what he's going to get up to with this badge and the stick they just gave him. He denies that he's angry, but the flashbacks seem to say otherwise.
The I'm not angry. What have I got to be angry about? The classic kissing cousin of what do I got to be depressed about?
Yeah.
That's not how feelings work,
man. My denial tells
me
I have nothing to be angry about.
Right, right.
Yeah. He's clearly seething. He just doesn't know how to express it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's like, what have I got to be depressed about? And it's telling that he's like, that, all that stuff happened a long time ago. I don't want to have to live in the past. And she's like, well, that's why you're so damn angry.
Yeah.
Because you don't. Like, no one does. Like, you want to just go forward and be like, that's a one-time thing. But, unfortunately, as he's going to get shoved in his face again and again and again, even without the whole bullshit of the Cyclops, it is some bullshit that this white chief is giving out, pinning medals on people's chests and being like, hey, and he just skips the black guy because... can't touch the black. I mean, without the grand super sci-fi clan scheme, it's still fucking super in your face racist, and we'd be tough for him to deal with. It's impossible to deal with, it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah, he deals with it just in an interesting way. So moving on, Will's patrolling the streets when he sees a man burn a Jewish deli. This guy's name is Fred, by the way. I'm going to be... important later.
It's not George Remus, because that's how I referred to him in all of my notes. Because this is Glenn Fleshler, who famously portrayed George Remus in Boardwalk Empire. Had a very great.
I didn't know his real name.
I looked it up because he's also the Yellow King,
True Detective,
True Detective, and he's also he did really good work as the Chechenian, I think, gangster in Barry season one. Like, he just keeps kind of, and like he does something interesting and different with everyone else. Those three performances are completely different, and now he's got the racist Jewish deli firebomber under his belt.
So he burns this deli. Will arrests him and hauls him into the station, where the man puts his white word against Will's black one, and the other cops they say, we'll take it from here, and they throw up this symbol that we'll see throughout
the
episode.
The flicking booger gesture.
Uh-huh.
That I think that the clan, that's flicking boogers is how they showed love for each other.
I really need to check out the video to get what you're talking about there.
Superman blew that story wide open back in his radio dramas. Come on, kids. You don't want to be at the booger flippers, do you?
they're meant for kids. Afterward, Will goes to a newsstand where he's shoulder checked by the same guy he just arrested, and he asks the station desk clerk what the hell happened, and he's told, just go home, let it be. we are a racist police department here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They don't say that, but.
And I'm not racist, but what do you want me to do? Something about it? I mean, right. Come on. Just, yeah. Let's just get along, guy.
The newsstand guy here is clearly reading Action Comics number one, which mm-hmm. if you know anything about comic books at all, you probably know this is the first appearance of Superman. And they kind of talk about Superman as a character. And obviously that ties into like a lot of the stuff we've seen on the show. The scene with Lady True.
Sure.
Will Reeves' history.
What do you think the significance of the newspaper guy talking in German was? Because I thought that was interesting. And I feel like there's something there mm-hmm. about like... maybe he struck up a friendship with this guy and because there's one of the big theories was that Hood of Justice was a German strongman, and it had like a German accent and you wonder like if you take everything that Hollis Mason, what the hell was the Night Owl's name? Hollis, no. Whatever his name was, the Night Owl one. If you take everything he said at face value, then you got a lot of questions like, you know, mm-hmm. what's the German accent? What's with this? I wonder if this is like Lindelof's kind of like winking explanation for it, or if there's some other kind of like social commentary he's making about immigrants and being attracted to these stories of heroes. And
I mean, we know clearly that he was misled in his tales of Hood of Justice, right? Because he assumed that he was a white guy. We know that not to be true now. So yeah, I don't know how much we can take seriously what he said. About Hood of Justice.
Sure.
The other thing, I think you might have brought this up in the instant take, but I feel like it warrants a little more discussion, is how fucking stupid do these people think Will and everyone else around them who's not supposed to know that they're part of the KKK are? Because when you flash this symbol, like, let's say during this podcast, you just started flashing a random symbol.
Like...
In my view. No, not that one.
No?
Let's try a different one. How about this one?
All right.
I don't know what that means, let's say. But wouldn't my first question be, what does that mean?
Sure.
Why did you just do that? What's the context for that?
But that's because...
And they must have to, hundreds of times a day, have to answer this question. What does that mean? Why did you just do that? What is that?
Well, I think... You're right, but I think it's a part of like, you know, the Klansmen are probably not as clever as they think they are. And two, like the idea that like this secret society that could actually survive without the tacit support of the white establishment. Like, you know, like they're relying on guys like this desk jockey to be like, oh, yeah, I see that and I know what it is. But fuck me if I'm going to get involved with the Klan or the Cyclops or whatever, because like nothing good can happen to that. Like maybe... You know, if I want to be charitable, maybe 9 out of 10 police officers feel like that's a bunch of bullshit and they don't want to be associated with it. But if they're all intimidated by the one, then, you know, there's like this. I read this quote about something about living.
I thought peer pressure worked the other way. Majority force the minority into their own behaviors.
Yeah, but like what you tolerate, it's like, you know, what do you have if you have a Nazi drinking with 5 of his friends at a table? Mm-hmm. You got 6 Nazis. That's like one of
you should have 6 non-Nazis.
You should have, or you should have 5 non-Nazis to tell this other Nazi to get the fuck out of here. But like, that's not how this shit kind of, like, again, the only way, because it's not clever, it's not particularly well hidden. The only way it survives is by the tacit support of the majority. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they're playing with here. Because yeah, you're right. It is a bunch of silly shit.
I mean, it's so obvious. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, let's move on to sometime later. Will is walking alone when a few cops roll up and ask him to join them for a beer. He declines, but the cops grab him later in an alley and beat the shit out of him and then drag him out to a tree where they hang him. They cut him down just before he passes out and tell him stay out of white folks' business or next time they won't cut him down. Then he walks home, stopping to save a couple who are being beaten in an alley. And when he gets home, he confesses to his wife that he is in fact angry.
Yeah, I like that. He's like, okay, I'm angry.
Yeah,
you know, has his, you know, his can't knuckles, his face, his blood. Yeah,
I just beat the shit out of a bunch of people in an alley.
I also really like minimalist superhero costumes. Like, I really liked, you know, Peter Parker. There's always an iteration where he's just got under, you know, like long johns that he's marked the spider on. Like, season 1 Daredevil, the blind justice look. Just this guy. you know, wearing civilian clothes with just his hood and noose around is kind of fucking metal.
It's like a scarecrow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's spooky. Like, that's the thing is, like, the one of the things I saw going around a lot this week is people like, it's kind of obvious in retrospect, this idea that you'd have this black superhero pretending to be a white man in a mask. And he's, and like, if you think about it in that terms, like, his costume just instantly comes together and like, oh, otherwise it's like, what the fuck is this guy? He's got this thing. And he's like, he's a hangman. Like, he's like the hangman's justice, but also why has he got the noose around his neck and why are his wrists bound? And it's this one of the world's greatest retcons of all time. Almost to the point where, like, I wish Alan Moore wasn't such a tool and he would actually watch this and give his opinion, because, like, it would be kind of interesting to see if that was something he always kind of noodled with, the idea that this was, I don't think in a million years that was the case, but holy shit. Like, yeah, this, and there's a lot of people saying that, like, every time they read The Watchmen now, it's going to be with this in mind, because it's just such a fantastic idea to reframe Hooded Justice this way.
Yeah, I think so. These scenes are super effective. As a viewer, I'm watching this just going, like, you know, with all tales of racial prejudice, I'm, you know, looking at the injustice and going, God, that's sickening. But also, like, the physicality of it here with the beatings and the hanging and everything, just, man, extremely engaging scenes that really put me in the position of Will.
Yeah, and this isn't just some dude on the street. This is a police officer.
Yeah. Like, yeah, there's no justice to be had.
No, there's nowhere to be safe,
right,
in this world for Will. And
that's the
black
thing that
like him.
I think Will was always counting on, right? Like, why he probably joined the police force in the first place, to try and get that justice.
I want to be like Bass Reeves. I want to find and expose and bring these people to justice. And the fact that he's being beaten and cowed and made to feel powerless is, you know, that second traumatizing event that, like, kicks off his superhero career.
Yeah, and this is all illustrated in the next scene where his wife...
Let me ask you this. Is that tree they hung him from... No, it can't be, because this is in New York. But right. It looks so much like the tree...
I had that same question, yeah.
The tree that Judd got hung from, that it's crazy. It's almost like I would believe that Lady True dug it up and moved it over.
Oh, God.
Because it looks so much like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, let's move on to Will's wife nursing his wounds the next day. Says he was in the paper, and she then uses this near-hanging event and the movie he used to watch as a child to make the point that he is not going to get justice with a badge. He's only going to get it with the hood, and she paints the area around his eyes white to protect his identity and to also give white folk a cause to believe in some way, right? And he becomes Hooded Justice. Like, it's
masks on masks.
Yeah, he's got to become, you know, this masked superhero, but also change his own personal identity in some ways in order to get any kind of justice that he's looking for.
Yeah,
seems like an injustice within itself. It's
like makes
up.
You think that, like, if Superman were a black man, would he have to wear white face to get anything done?
Right.
You know, because, like, as we've seen, 1930s America, not super, super progressive when it comes to race.
Yeah, the hilarious thing, you know, hilarious in the saddest possible way, is that he could probably have green skin, he could probably have blue skin in the case of Dr. Manhattan, and people would accept him more than if he had black skin.
Depends.
Certainly in 1930s America.
I would love to see what people's reaction would have been to Dr. Manhattan had he started off life as a black man and not a white man.
Yeah. No, it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Because I bet, or that it wouldn't matter because he'd still be Dr. Manhattan. But whatever angst people felt about this guy being God would be like 10 times more angsty, I think.
Yeah, this scene, I really like this scene because it's in some ways a complete destruction of... sort of what Will thought of the world. Like, his entire worldview is torn down in these last two scenes.
Yeah, this is the death of that. Like, this is why the anger could no longer be contained, because he was just hoping to channel it into some healthy, and this avenue is denied to him.
And this movie is shown to be a sham. The real world doesn't work that way, especially the world in which they're living.
Yeah.
And these two scenes really serve as kind of the instigator of the whole Hooded Justice thing, obviously.
Yeah.
So then
it kind of breaks my heart, though, that I think, because I one of the things I was thinking about when she was given the speech is like, how many black families have that talk about like Black Panther? Like, yeah, that's the movie, but this is not real life. Like, there is no Wakanda. There's nobody that's looking out for you. There's, you know, you gotta, and like, you know, how bad that must suck to be that, like, yeah, like now that you're getting some representation as and seen heroic, is like, don't let it get to your head, because it's too lollipop and sunshine and kittens. And I know, yeah. I have to imagine those conversations are taking place.
Yeah, I think so. With any self-aware kind of parenting, I think absolutely they would. So then Hood of Justice stakes out Fred's warehouse, and a few men go in the back door, gaining access with this Cyclops symbol that we've seen. So Will follows them in, and he kicks all of their asses, their whole asses. He also finds evidence that their organization is probably nationwide, if not, you know, it's at least regional.
Yeah,
it's spreading across the country.
Yeah,
he's chased out of this general store by Fred with a shotgun, jumping through a window to escape, and we kind of freeze there. And I'll talk about the rest of it later.
And what a brilliant way to reframe like Petey's obsession with the historical accuracy of the Minutemen, because like I think like he praised that like initial scene of where, and it's like fictional on many different levels. You know, the fact that it's, you know, obviously he's a black man, but he was not there to stop a crime or a robbery. He was there to expose this like vast insidious conspiracy.
Yeah. And there's some comeuppance a little bit for Petey in the Petypedia.
Yeah.
Around that, where he says basically like he didn't have the historical knowledge that he thought he had.
What's up with the lettuce?
Because yeah, like the first shotgun blast goes through a pile of lettuce.
Is that just a private joke, or is there something to the lettuce? Some powerful
lettuce
clan.
A symbol of racism?
I don't know.
That's I've been eating it for years. Yeah. I should probably know if it's true.
I know. Well, I mean, like I've been that's the thing.
So like don't drink the Kool-Aid, don't eat the lettuce.
Yeah, no, that's a weird thing that the online fascists are doing nowadays, is they like keep claiming different random symbols, like, oh, if you if you pose with a glass of white milk, or if you do that with your fingers crossed, or if you do that with your dick in a rutabaga. Like eventually it's like it's so ridiculous that like it collapses under its own weight. And I think that's actually happening now. Like just like when Superman started talking about the Klan and treating him serious as an enemy, it's just like, well, this is just fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, I don't give a shit whether the OK symbol is a racist symbol or not. Like, you know, why you have your dick in a rutabaga, man? Like, who are you even doing this for now? Like, owning the libs? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, and I mean, it has to, it's something that if it's going to have that meaning, it has to catch on in a larger context.
Yeah.
Or in the larger culture.
Or it's just the OK sign on the forehead. It's a booger flicker gesture. It's like, OK.
Right. Or like, racists are the only one who see it as racist, and therefore, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't mean that.
But I think
generally,
that's the utility, that like you can use it unironically, and then someone calls you on it. Oh, I'm just, you know, that's just the internet joke. Where if someone's like, aha, I see you, brother, then it's like, you know, exchange booger flicks and you're on your way. Like, it's incredibly useful in that capacity. And maybe maybe romaine lettuce. It's been the racist lettuce. I think we've all been thinking it. We've all been suspecting for a long time.
Yeah,
you know, iceberg,
yeah,
stand up lettuce,
recall,
this romaine shit.
Every time they recall it, I'm just like, why did they recall this? Why did they really?
Fascist lettuce.
I'm not E. coli. No, no. How much E. coli you think there is?
It's
a lot less than there is racism. I can tell you that much.
Adolf Hitler engineered romaine lettuce to spread salmonella to the masses.
Mind control. Mind control lettuce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of mind control, in this scene, we see a couple of things. Not just that Cyclops stuff is spreading, but also there's this book called Mesmerism for the Masses that he picks up, and that will, you know, come into play significantly later.
I also liked, in addition to all the commentary, that he has a lot of visual stuff, like, you know, he punched someone through the lookout, like, you know, the fake one punched the camera, and then there's a lot of the same moves with tables and chairs from the cold open, was stuff that the real Hood of Justice did in this scene. I thought it was interesting the way they're kind of remixing real history with fake history, keeping in mind it's all kind of fake history.
Yeah,
it's I like what they're doing with that.
I really like the choreography.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
these fight scenes are really good.
Really, like, cool. Really good.
The one that gets me is when this Klan's members got him in a headlock, and he just does this backwards body slam right on the guy's head.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't like actually show the impact, but you feel it. Some good stuff there. Then we move on to kind of a break in the action. Angela / Will is still frozen in this through the window freeze frame.
It's the Zack Snyder shot.
Yeah, and Laurie and Cal show up through this haze of memories to try and pull Angela out of the effects of nostalgia. They've given her a shot of adrenaline, and they're trying to read her this prepared statement, but it doesn't really work. She's sucked back into the memories.
I love how they're trying to, like, their faces are, like, pulsing with color, like it's trying to resolve the reality, but she's just...
Her heart's probably beating at 130 BPMs. And
yeah, but she's got way too many of Grandpa's memories chugging their way through the bloodstream, and it's not not all the adrenaline in the world, Lori.
No.
It's gonna end this trip.
Heart's gonna explode before that happens. And then Nelson Gardner shows up at Will's house. We're back in the memories now. And he's got this thinly veiled offer to have Hooded Justice join a new team that Captain Metropolis is forming called the Minutemen. This is sort of the origin story of the original Minutemen from the comic. And he lures them into the deal by vaguely promising that the Minutemen will go after the Cyclops. No one is fooled by this subterfuge at all. In fact, when the jig is like halfway up, Will's wife just bursts out laughing because it's all so thinly veiled. It's all so obvious,
right?
And she calls Nelson Gardner on him being Captain Metropolis. It's really good.
I see you flicking boogers.
Yeah,
you can't. This is some thinly veiled shit.
Yeah, and there's a hint. So like, this is where the homosexual stuff starts to come in, right? There's this like touch of the hand when he's passing him the business card.
It's the sex stuff you referred to.
The sex stuff, yeah. Turns out he does use the hood for sex stuff. You know, the guy's not totally wrong. But his wife, I think, takes note of it, right? She looks over it and she's like, got this very...
No, they have an interesting relationship. Like I said, like, I don't know how, like a 6, 7, 8-year-old boy... forms like a romantic relationship with this infant that he kind of adopts. As I would think they would fall into like a brother sister type relationship. So I was actually somewhat surprised later when she mentioned being pregnant, because I was thinking like maybe they're not even in like a sexual relationship at all.
No, seemed to be.
But you know, this is a kind of relationship of convenience. But like, the more I watched it, the more I'm like, I don't really care. Like,
yeah, that's not the point.
Yeah.
Like, yes, they are gay lovers. So what? Like, if let me ask you this. If there are people out there who are like, rah, go kick the racist ass. And then they look at it and they go, oh, God, he was gay.
Yeah, that too.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, what are we doing here? If you can't be offended by either of these things.
Right.
If you're not offended by either of them.
Yeah, there might be something they're doing here with like... you know, one of the things that like the FBI used to try to take down Martin Luther King and a lot of black activists is like, you know, either drug scandal or a sex scandal. And, you know, that's one of the things that the dirt they tried to, they did collect on Martin Luther King, the fact that he was not faithful to his wife. And I wonder if they're like, you know, and a lot of people, like, if you know things about Martin Luther King, you know about his, you know, work towards on civil rights, but also you probably know about the infidelity that people smeared him with. But like a lot, hardly anybody knows about like, the fact that Martin Luther King advocated for socialism. And I wonder if it's like one of those things where it's like a secret buried beneath a secret. Kind of like they're trying to, you know, everyone is speculating about, oh, he's gay. That's the Hood of Justice secret, that like it further protects the other truth about him that never gets out. I don't know. Because I'm always, that's the thing. It's like Lindelof is working on like 3 different levels on almost every scene. So like, it's not just nothing that this guy is in a bisexual relationship, unconventional bisexual relationship here.
Yeah, I don't think
what
so.
What does it mean?
So moving on to probably that night, certainly a little bit later, the two men are having sex and they talk about why Will joining the Minutemen is so vital. Although Captain Metropolis here tells him, like, look, if you do join, you'll have to stay covered up because some of the Minutemen are not as open-minded as he is. Later, Will's wife worries about him joining the Minutemen and says She asked him to recount the story of the first time they met, and then tells him that she's pregnant. Spoiler alert, they met as children.
Yeah.
We find out, I think, in this scene that they were.
Yeah.
That she's the baby mm-hmm. that he picked up in the field.
Yeah, and he does something interesting in this performance. Like, he shows he has very mixed feelings. Like, it seems like he's happy initially to hear that there's a baby on the way, but then also, like, this kind of worry and doubt. And it's got to be because that's something else that Lindelof talked about in yes. the podcast, is that, like, children are very antithetical to, like, a heroic lifestyle because, mm-hmm. you know...
Attachments in general, any kind of attachments, certainly children.
But certainly children is, like, the most attached you can be to another being on a planet. And there's a reason a lot of superheroes don't have children, mm-hmm. And they don't get married, for that matter. And I definitely think you can kind of see that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's played that way.
That Joelle Monique had on the AV Club, I talked about her in the beginning of the podcast, but she had a really interesting take on this scene when she said to Captain Metropolis saying, you know, well, you have to cover up around everybody because the other heroes aren't as tolerant as me. She explains that this is coded language for, like, I'm not racist, but my friends hate you. And she goes in to talk about similar phrases like, well, you're not black, or well, you're a credit to your race, or you're so articulate. And
you're not black. That's an insult, right?
Yeah. And she mentioned that these are negotiations most black Americans manage internally when entering conversations with white individuals, particularly those with power. How am I being used? Does my appearance here hurt my community? Are the words being said to me genuine? Can these promises be kept? Should I leave this opportunity on the table and attempt to forge my own way? And it's like, all those things were not obvious to me, but, like, mm-hmm. I thought she helped me appreciate. It's like, you know, what a minefield it must be, like, when a white person, like, takes a shine to you. Like, hey, how can I help you? Like, that's even when it's not meant to be, that's fucking loaded language.
Absolutely. And this turns out to be exactly that, right? Captain mm-hmm. Metropolis is really only interested in starting up this group for his own seemingly personal, financial,
right.
Reputational gain. He doesn't have any interest in pursuing the goals of Hooded Justice.
Yeah, he's co-opting and appropriating this black man's cultural innovation, dressing up in a hood and beating the shit out of people for his own... To later popularize and profit off of it.
Yeah, and we see that in the very next scene where Will agrees to join the Minutemen, and then he tries to give this speech about this KKK problem in the city, but he's cut off by Captain Metropolis, who wants to focus on Moloch, and he turns the press conference into this really gross and racist sponsorship opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the National Bank poster that he unveils here.
Which Angela, we saw her like in episode 2, kind of like wrinkle her nose at when she saw it.
Right.
Like, huh, interesting.
Yeah, like it... It makes me wonder if Captain Metropolis is not on board with your goals and you have a mind control machine, why are you not using it?
Maybe he did.
And it just didn't work?
No, I mean, well, you read that letter, that will that, mm-hmm. that Captain Metro leaves, and you work backwards from the principle that, like, you know, maybe that wasn't like a Saul on the road to Damascus kind of light flashing moment. Maybe that was, or if it was a light flashing, maybe it's a movie light flashing. Like, I don't know. There's, you could read that as saying, like, that's not a genuine conversion. That's Will using his camera technology to turn Captain Metropolis. And then if he did.
In 1971? Like, that's an awful long time to wait to accomplish your goal if you have the mesmerizer in the 30s. Or
does mesmerizer
40s.
Work after one exposure, though? Because I feel like that this was something that, like, they were working on the community over time. It's not like the first time they did it, like, bam, this Capitol Theater. But I don't
know. We don't I ever don't see Judd exposed to it other than this one time. So I would assume
that's
it
true.
Works on the first
yeah,
time.
You're right. The technology, it's not like you have to be built up to it.
But clearly it's modified tech, too, right? Probably with Lady True's help.
Yeah.
It's been flashlighted.
Oh, yeah, maybe they've perfected
form.
It, yeah.
Right, miniaturized a little bit.
Yeah.
Although not all that much.
Yeah,
you
that's
would,
true.
You would think it could be miniaturized a little more
sure. uh-huh.
than this huge, it looks like it takes eight D-cell batteries.
Well, if they had Manhattan batteries widely available, but they're
making, but they're short supply. Yeah, the KKK's got them all.
Yeah, the racists have dominated the LiPo market. Yeah, in this dystopia.
It does just seem weird to me that the Minutemen would go on for years and years and years, not, you know, promoting the causes of hooded justice when he's got mind control gear.
Yeah. Well, anyway. And also, like, what? There's a lot of, like, yada yada after, you know, like, what? I think we know enough about Will to see why he was disillusioned with the hero stuff and why he retired and you know, kind of left in disgust. But also, Will doesn't seem like the type of guy who would abandon his crusade for justice that easily. So there is, these memories are the things that Will wanted Angela to know. And there's a lot left out, like from, you know, the time he tries to keep his son from following his footsteps to it, like, flashes forward to the night of justice. So where are the missing things there?
There's still a lot missing.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't see exactly when he hung it up. What was the straw that broke the camel's back? Was it a gradual process? What was he doing? Like, we have little bits and pieces in his PDF file of, like, you know, the fact he was running a movie projector, or he's running a theater in Harlem. That's super interesting for a guy with mind control movie technology. Like, what might he be doing with that in Harlem for maybe positive effect? Like, what was his mission? What did he do in the times where he was in remission and out of public eye?
And I would be curious to know if there's some, like, epicenter of you know, civil rights brewing in 75 in Harlem. I didn't do the historical research.
I look because you know, you've always heard of the Harlem Renaissance, but that took place, like, in the 20s. It was kind of the New York version of the Black Wall Street going on in Tulsa. And I didn't see any, like, corresponding thing in, like, the 60s or 70s, but I did as much research as you can do in a day and a half.
Right.
Between the episode aired. So forgive me if I got that wrong.
The other thing that this mind control tech kind of throws into question, which we're not even at that scene yet. It's the next one. But let's talk about it. Is it provides a little more context on what Lady True might be talking about when she says this nostalgia stuff is a very passive aggressive route to go with Angela. Because he could just point that flashlight at her and get her to do whatever she needs to do to kind of see, you know, what her past is. And, like,
sure,
if they need Angela to do something specific, they could make her do it. Yeah.
But then, as he said, you could do the same thing with your daughter, I guess, which,
right.
So why? It's more like, you know, there's this similar concept in Mr. Robot, like, that you don't want, you want someone to join your cause of their own free will, not because they're forced to. And like, you know, this idea of, like, well, if you knew what I knew, you'd be on my side. Like, that you hear that, you got to walk a mile in someone's shoes to understand them. Like, this is a great, I mean, if this drug were real, it would solve a lot of the world's problems.
Nostalgia.
Yeah. Like, if you could like live through a few other people's lives, not just here in the United States, but around the world, like, you know, we talk about this, like, that is an empathy bomb. Yep. You know, like, it's hard to judge a person when you know exactly how they feel and the struggles they've been through and perfect contrast to your own. So I could see, Now, it's interesting, like, why would Angela hate him after this? And that's why I'm thinking there's another shoe to drop, because this seems like it would be a fairly heroic reframing. Like, she's got some complicated feelings about Judd and how he's mixed up with all this, because he died kind of professing his innocence. Yeah. But, you know, did he really intend her to hate him because he killed Judd? Because I kind of feel like she believed that anyway. Like, she knew it was, like, impossible, but also, he did it somehow. So I don't know. I think there's something else that's going to be revealed that will be... make her hate him.
Yeah, we now have two forms of sort of persuasion. We've got nostalgia, which can be a powerful persuasive drug if fed the right memories. It could also, with the mesmerizing stuff, could be a mind control device. We're and I'm talking about this in, like, context of the Millennium Clock that we know is about to be completed. There are a lot of theories out there about what that could be, and we were all kind of on this nostalgia bomb thing for a long time. You know, this puts a new wrinkle in it. It could be some sort of projecting device that will get everyone within the vicinity to do what they want. Now, I think it's interesting in context of the what we know about Lady True from the PDpedia now. She has 50-some... She's very involved in space tech technology. She's got like 50 Voyager-style probes out there. We know that she has an what they call an Eye on Mars, which is an observation platform, which I assume is very similar to the one that is around Europa.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where we saw that footage of Manhattan destroying the sandcastle.
Right. Now, I'm saying all this to wonder if she could use her space tech somehow to project worldwide something, some kind of signal that would force people to do something.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, with a flashing light theory, it's like, man, that millennium clock, I wonder, like, you could probably see that for, I don't know how many miles. It's so tall and big. Like, if there's, like, on the launch, yeah, if everyone goes outside to look at whatever it's going to do, and she does some kind of light show that does... But then it's like question mark.
Yeah.
What exactly would she be doing with it?
And what does that have to do with telling time, right? Because I think we're all still broadly on board with the idea that statement was like kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Same reason Flavor Flav carried that big clock. He wanted motherfuckers to know what time it was, Jim.
All right. Yeah. That sense of tell time. That's what she meant.
Yeah. The next three episodes are going to be a rap opera set to Public Enemy.
Man, bring it on. I want that now. I have to see it.
There'll be a 3,000-foot tall Flavor Flav with the Millennium Clock around his neck. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's, I guess, talk about the mind control scene, because we've talked all about it, but haven't recapped it.
Mm-hmm.
A few years pass as their child is born and grows into a boy. Probably like 6 to 8 years old.
Yeah.
Say he's Kevin McAllister's age.
And the important thing is you see him like looking at his dad, putting on like this is not a hidden identity to your family, which like seems like a liability when that kid goes off to school. But
yeah,
but he's enthralled with his father and what he's doing here. The same way Will was with his father and seeing that kind of that. Mm-hmm.
With Bass Reeves.
Yes, that he was like, you know, wanted to put on his son, his father's uniform.
Yeah, absolutely. Riot breaks out at a black theater and Will is sent in to deal with it. He asks a woman what happened and she said some lights started flickering and she felt compelled to hurt someone. Will tries to report that the Klan is using mind control to turn the black community against itself to Captain Metropolis.
Was this black lady a psychic and she like this is a psychic blast? Because like it wasn't clear to me what the fuck she did. Like, what was the actual, like the streets flipped, shit's flipped over in the streets, things are sparking, it looked like a bomb goes off, and like...
I think they just all started attacking each other.
Oh.
Because later on
they
in the episode...
They did say it's like a riot, right? So it's everyone spontaneous turned on each other. Okay. Okay, because like...
Yeah, and people ripped chairs out. And...
Like the central, like the lady sitting there and crying made it feel like she was at the epicenter, and I'm like, well, maybe she's like latent psychic power, and... But like, okay, it makes...
Okay.
It, what you're,
it's
what
like
you
a
said
Jean
makes
Grey
more
sort
sense.
Of thing, yeah. So Captain Metropolis thinks this is ridiculous. But then Fred shows up. And Will puts a bullet in his head, then goes inside his warehouse and kills every Klan member he can find. He burns the bodies and the warehouse, but not before swiping a mesmerizer for himself. This is a scene where we kind of see, you know, exactly why the riot broke out.
They're recording a mesmerizing track that's about just like, you know, attacking. It's delivered to a black audience and it's talking about it, you know, turning towards each other, never attack a white person.
Right.
Pretty gross shit.
Yeah, it's I think classic divide and conquer strategy, but also it allows them affords the racist white community a sort of PR win. Like they can point to this and say,
sure,
look at this. Uh-huh. These people are terrible, when in fact they've manufactured this whole damn thing from the beginning.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like, I think that's a real lie. That's the thing that bothered me is like, line that you can clearly draw through history. And I don't think it's really stopped to our day. And it felt weird to frame that as like a technological conspiracy rather than like a supervillain plot rather than like a systemic kind of effort, systemic and decentralized effort. But you know, they have a good point that like a lot of a lot of that has spread traditionally is through media portrayals and going back to the birth of the nation, going back to, you know, how up until very recently minorities have been portrayed in media as, like, you know, mostly like gangsters and thugs and so, like, I get what they're trying to do. It's still weird to me, and it wouldn't also surprise me if there's another reveal that maybe draws us into a little bit sharper focus, but I think I appreciate what they're doing with what they're doing.
Yeah. When Will gets home, his son is dressed up in his Hood of Justice uniform. Will freaks out about it, and his wife tells him that the hood has turned him into a monster, essentially, and she takes his son and leaves for Tulsa.
I loved what they're doing with the soundtrack here. This kind of, like, chaotic, improvised jazz kind of drumming to kind of show the
they do it a couple times this episode.
Yeah. And it's always, there's this, like, you know, particular around these particular emotions. And it's funny because, like, does Will not want his son to become him? Because clearly his father did not want him to become who he was, which was another angry black man. But it's like, you know, it feels like he's trying to round up, close the barn door while the horse is already well out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this ties in with, you know, the idea of legacy that Lindelof et al. Are going for.
Yeah.
This stuff, you know, permeates the boundaries of the generations, whether you want it to or not. And, you know, whether you think that's a physical transference via chemicals in a mother's womb or something, or if you think it's just a cultural one, I think this episode does a lot to sort of illustrate that. And it worked for me. Then we transition to the night of Judd's death, modern day again. Old Will uses a flashlight-sized version of the Mesmerizer to mind-control Judd into hanging himself. Then Angela is pulled out of these memories by Will's wife.
Yeah, I don't. That's
sort of. I mean, like
this. I think you're right. But I'm also wondering.
It's like she's talking to her, but also maybe to Will.
Yeah, and like that's where the missing pieces are. Like, who is she talking to? I think you're supposed to understand she's talking to maybe Angela. But how would Will know that?
Yeah.
If they never reconciled, and it seems like from a lot of the information we had that they didn't. Like, this is one of the central mysteries. Like, who is that lady to Angela? Who is that lady to Will?
Right.
And
this is one of the things I think he wants her to realize eventually.
But why?
Yeah.
To what end?
And then she finds herself in a bed at Lady True's house. And I think that they probably just essentially use dialysis on Angela to pull these chemicals out of her system.
Yeah, something.
It looks like the device is filtering blood.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
So no, I don't think, like, we speculate on the instant take that maybe all these are suppression chemicals somehow were injecting her with something that blocked the nostalgia, and maybe that's what doing
it
to your daughter.
And I wonder
could
if that's,
be, but it looks like dialysis to me.
Yeah, no, I could that explain the gap in history why it flat that, like, you know, she was having the chemicals removed, so like she didn't get all the memories processed? Because there is like a fairly big gap in history between what the mid 50s and 2019. Like that entire with a flash of old black lady, mysterious black lady thrown in there as a bridge.
Right. I think we need to remember. So yes, as she's coming out of it, I think that's definitely the case. Like, there were more memories that she could have had access to, but we have to remember, like, these are memories specifically chosen by Will.
Well, not only that, but Lady True's working for Will, so, like, why would she, like, whatever she saw was, and she was intended to see, no more, no less, because, like, you know.
Unless, they're somehow not working together anymore, but they are.
Yeah.
They've got to be.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like one of these scenes indicates that Will at some point went to Tulsa after his wife and son left and was just told to leave again.
Yeah, because there's like this, also she's coming out of, there's that voiceover where she says, you know, you stay away from Tulsa and me and your son. But I don't know if she said that as like the final thing she said to Will before she walked out of the door in New York, or like she was in Tulsa. Why did she think she was in Tulsa?
I thought she looked older in that scene.
Was that scene the same scene where she says, she does look like you, I'm going to take you home now, honey?
I don't know, man.
Yeah, because there's also that
just
still,
like, flashing and it's
that's
got
to be tied into the accident in Vietnam and how her and Cal, like, you know, her parents dying and then this person who's, I get.
Right.
But why wouldn't she remember, you know, like, if
I don't know.
It's. And also, how would Will know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all a couple mysteries. I suspect we're going to get answers to these a lot earlier than we're going to get answers to, like, the clock. But shit, there's only three episodes left, so I'm not going to have to wait long for apparently any of these things, according to Lindelof.
And that's the end of this one. We should talk about the PDpedia real quick.
Okay, PDpedia. I guess I should be explaining this every week, but this is an actual, like, alternate reality game, kind of, sort of, that HBO is running on the HBO website. You can get to it by searching for the PD files.
And if you're a fan of the comic book, you'll compare them, as Lindelof does, to the sort of inserts that were between chapters in the original comics.
Yep. And the first one is a memo entitled "Who Has One Eye and Loves Evil's Plans," and this is a memo written from the perspective of Lori. And
I love it. It's the rebuttal. It's the response to all the shitty memos that Petey's been sending out about Lori's past.
All these passive aggressive, you know, she's kind of calling him out for his talking out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And she also she gives him a couple directives to find this will that we're going to read next. Will and testament, not like our will, Will Reeves. And also to bring in Mirror. Go ahead and bring in Mirror Guy, because he flips so fast on Angela that it's suspicious to her.
I said this at the end of the last episode. I'm like, is Looking Glass going to be hauled in? Because damn, that looks suspicious.
It sure does.
And apparently she is. And that's what makes me feel like they're keeping us exactly one episode ahead of the timeline with these PDpedia things.
Mm-hmm. She mentioned something we already talked about, which is Angela talked this entire experience, like 4 or 5 hours into this trip. I guess nostalgia abuse is called waxing. So five hours into his waxing trip, she got all this stuff recorded on tape. So everything that Angela knows, I think you understand. Maybe she doesn't have all the context around it, but, like, you know, she clearly picked up the Cyclops thing. Mm-hmm. She sees the connection between that and the Seventh Cavalry. She understands that Angela's grandfather murdered Judd with a mind control device. The other thing is, like, it seems like this mind control technology is not common knowledge. Like, this is something,
because she comments that, oh, the 7K.
Yeah. And then she mentions that there's this MC tech that the clan was working on in the 40s and 50s. And I'm guessing that means mind control, you know, MC mind control tech.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess people's conception of it is that it just never worked. Or maybe it's like, you know, that MK Ultra shit the CIA was doing in the 60s. Uh-huh. It's like, let's inject people with LSD and shit.
Or any of the Nazi experiments,
to see if it worked. But, like, it didn't really lead to anything, because it's they're crazy. They're fundamentally crazy experience. But in this in this universe, that yielded some bad fruit.
And she says that she's going to go visit Judd's widow to see what information she can get about him being in the Klan.
And
so expect to see that next episode.
And she also reminds him to feed her owl, who, because he needs to eat mice. Then the next file is entitled "Evidence: The Will of Nelson Gardner," who we know as Captain Metropolis. And this is Petey reporting back at the direction of Agent Blake that she sent him to go find this will. And he gives a bunch of background information on Nelson Gardner, that he served as a Marine in the Banana Wars. Have you heard about the Banana Wars, Jim?
No.
This is, like, where the term Banana Republic comes from.
To the point where I thought it was fake, because it's such a stupid name.
Yeah, it is. And it's a really stupid war, but there's a period in the 30s starting in 1900 where United States started flexing its muscle in the tropics, the Caribbean, the Bahamas, Central South America, and they would take over and install friendly regimes so that fruit companies could successfully exploit these countries for their tropical fruit exports, chiefly bananas.
Okay.
And Nelson apparently served under his Major General Smedley Butler, and I looked him up.
That is the opposite of a badass name. No. That is no Samuel Battle.
No, we need a Smithy Warface or something to equal that. But he wrote a book in 1935, which is kind of 5 years after all this died down, called "War is a Racket." This is one of the chief heroes of the Banana Wars, whereupon he denounced the role that he had played in the wars, describing himself as a high-class muscle for big business, for Wall Street, and for bankers, a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism.
Hmm.
So there's a guy regretting his involvement in some Banana Wars,
which is on theme for Gardner.
Also shows that this will was presented to Will, Reeves at his place of employment in the 1970s, a movie theater in Harlem.
Yeah.
Which, as we've mentioned, is interesting. That Nelson Gardner died coming home from protesting the repeal of the 22nd Amendment, which, if you don't know, is the amendment that codified that presidents can only serve for two terms, no longer.
We know his protest did not work.
Yeah, it did not. And crucially, he was ejected from his vehicle in this accident, decapitated, his head never found, and his will directed that his remains be thoroughly destroyed.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are picking up on the fact that maybe he didn't die here, that he faked his death for some unknown reason. But the long shot of the will is that he left everything to Will Reeves. They haven't spoken since 1955. He hasn't even heard from Will since he sent a sternly written letter rejecting affiliation with the Crime Busters back in 1966. And he says if Will doesn't take the physical inheritance, which includes a lot of Minutemen memorabilia and copyrights and other stuff, to donate that to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he also wants them to impress upon Will the fact that this giant donation of money is intended as an apology and penance for his sins against him and his neglect and subversion of his noble work. And that he since learned that all stances are political, even non-political stances, and that he realized he derived much of his wealth and fame from association with the Hood of Justice and his appropriation of his imagery. So my question is, this is a large sum of money that might be useful for a crime fighter to fight crime and injustice on a larger scale. Are we to understand that maybe Will took this money at some point?
Could be, yeah. I mean, the end of that will also says that his assets are to be liquidated. If Will doesn't want it, liquidate my assets, put it in a trust, and leave it there with the impression that it is there for him when he wants it.
Yeah.
And if not, just let it fucking rot.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's even if he doesn't accept it at the time of presentation, he could have gone back for it later.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if we have like a third stage Bruce Wayne situation where now Hood of Justice had some money behind him.
Okay.
And you know, what has he been involved in, like, any of the Adrian Veidt stuff? He's clearly involved in Lady True stuff, which, as we're going to discuss in this next clip, this next clip is Lady True Fact or Fiction, and this is written in the style of a puff piece by a high society kind of scribbler, you know, like the type of person like a Vanity Fair that would go and sit one-on-one with Elon Musk or Elon Tusk and see what they're all about. But it turns out Lady True doesn't grant interviews, and she didn't do it this one. So this is the reporter propounding a bunch of salacious facts about Lady True to her publicist, and her publicist either answers it or denies it or whatever. What are some things that kind of jumped out at you, Jim?
So a lot of stuff about her mother. She wrote a book about, well, first of all, she wanted to raise a genius, the smartest person or whatever. So she set out specifically to do that and then wrote a memoir about it called Pachyderm Mom, essentially translated, which...
Have you heard of the Tiger Mom
essentially
book?
Means thick-skinned mom. Yes, I have heard of
that. Yeah, this Asian lady by the name of Amy Chua.
Yeah.
Wrote it's kind of extolling, or I don't know. I did a lot of research, and it's like, I don't know if she's extolling it or she was just kind of explaining the way she's raised in like satirical look, but it's a common stereotype that Asian parents are demanding when it comes to like scholastic achievement and artistic achievement, and, you know, demand excellence, and, you know, can do things that some might consider emotionally abusive or manipulative in the goal to inspire and motivate their children. And this Pachyderm Mom, I think, is the gray, leathery, giant-eared counterpart to the Tiger Mom.
Right.
Yeah.
I found it sort of interesting that Lady True got to pick her own name at 5 years old.
Yeah.
I probably would have picked, like, Mario or Link.
Right.
She chose a historical figure, or potentially a mythological figure.
Well, also...
Much more cultured than I was at the same age.
The article mentions that Lady True plans to raise her own daughter by the same methodology, and is interesting that she chose to be named Bien, which is her mother's name.
Right.
But this also that's so delicious because it feeds into like, oh, this was a clone of her mother, or this is an attempt to...
Yeah, so there's a really interesting theory on Reddit, and I don't normally, when I read Reddit, note the usernames, but I wanted to here because... this theory is very much based on like cultural knowledge of the Vietnamese.
Mm.
It's user Yikesus, I think is how you pronounce that. Says essentially that this name means mystery or secret, and it's actually a very silly name for a Vietnamese person to have, and you might have it in 2019, but you damn sure wouldn't have had it in the 30s or 40s whenever Lady True's mother was born. It would be a truly ridiculous name back then. And also, this nightmare that Bian has, which is likely the, I don't know how to pronounce this, I think it's My Lai Massacre, which happened in 68. It's probably that real life event that she's remembering. And because of the lineup of the time that it happened, and also this thing, this person having the same name as the grandmother, as her grandmother, thinks that this is probably a clone of Lady True's mother, which I think makes a lot of sense when looked at from that perspective.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting to me that this would be a clone of her mother. I don't know how that changes, like, you know, the what effect it has on the story.
Well, I also, one of the ideas I had is that maybe this was a clone of Lady True herself, and that she's like running this like through an iterative process. Like, I'll eventually have a perfect child if my mom raised me this method, and I raise a clone of myself this method, and she continues to do this. Like,
but what if she raised a clone of her mom with that method? How perfect is that?
Is that better or worse? Because there was,
I mean, in, I gotta in know so many ways, it's better
her
and
mom
worse.
Was pachyderm mommed, or did she pioneer the concept?
Oh, the mom of the mom?
Yeah. Did this? I mean, clear. Okay, that's, I withdraw. That's ridiculous. Like,
yeah, come on. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
That's just silly.
Uh huh.
She also has 4 doctorates, astrophysics.
Got them by the age of 15.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
Astrophysics, nuclear fission, bioengineering, and nanochemistry, all things that you might be using if you were in space tech, if you were in, I don't know, mind control tech, energy tech.
Mm-hmm.
See a lot of that stuff.
Her mom hired a what was he, some kind of martial artist to train her daughter in the ways of fighting, and then the final exam was supposed to be a fight to the death, which the guy resigned.
Right.
But it's interesting.
But both a mental and physical fight to the death is what it was
framed as. Which was interesting in light of like what we've seen, you know, with the psychic blasts and like the mental control device, the technology. And the spokesperson is very dismissive of the claim.
Yeah.
But also you get the idea that the spokesperson is, you know, not telling the truth throughout the article. What did you think? We already talked about the fact she's launched these probes, and
yeah,
she's got this microfusion propulsion technology. Which, and
I was tying this in with the save. So have you seen the save my daughter theory or save me daughter theory?
No.
Around Vite. So we noted that it says save me D.
Yep.
We were thinking Dr. Manhattan. We were thinking Dan. We were thinking
just like
character names.
The members of the patriarchy. We overlooked the possibility that this is a cry for help from a woman or for a woman. God damn it. We got hoodwinked again.
Yeah, but if you think about, okay, this is most likely Lady True's satellite observation platform, whatever, that's picking him up here. Mm-hmm. Save me daughter would make a ton of sense. Perhaps. If he turns out to be her father somehow.
Yeah.
Don't know where the lead-in is on that theory, but it's not totally out of the question.
Yeah, and the whole idea of, like, reverence for one's ancestors also applies to your parents. So, like, that would show why she had him in especially high regard. Like, we see what she thinks about her mother. Like, she reveres her, so...
Absolutely, and I think it's also interesting that one of these paragraphs in here, one of these fact or fiction points... is that the comedian was her father. There could be a slight truth to this. It's not the comedian, however, it's Vite.
Hmm. Well, I mean, there's also like an interesting comment about like Lady Bian essentially neither confirming or denying that she had a relationship with the comedian other than that his unit visited her village and he was very charming. Like, I'm like, interesting. Because this all feeds into like the idea that like, the comedian got a girl, maybe even this was Lady True, is the one that the mother he killed. But we know that can't be true. And also this establishes that like there's between 7 and 10 kids that he fathered across the globe in his, doing dirty works for Uncle Sam.
Mm-hmm. And his sex stuff.
Yeah, yeah. She also supports there's apparently a rebel Vietnamese front that's fighting for independence. She supports their mm-hmm. cause, but not their methods.
Yep.
Also, she's the one that has learned to synthesize lithium so they could start using the Dr. Manhattan type of technology.
Mm-hmm.
She also funded a study to disprove the Manhattan cancer hypothesis. And apparently this thing where Dr. Manhattan built and destroys the sandcastle, this is something that like happens regularly, all the
over
time
and over again,
because the public has expressed like a boredom of watching it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. It's interesting. There's also this item, Millennium Clock, actually a time machine, which I think is like a little poke at the audience, but also, I thought it was cute. There's a reference here that they say Axon, they say Axon Inn. Which yeah. I had to look up because I had no fucking idea what they're talking about. Apparently, this is a radio play from a David Lynch film called Inland Empire
mm-hmm.
in 2006, which cast includes Laura Dern, who just comes up in the bald move lore constantly
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Justin Theroux, who you might recognize as sure. one of the leads from Leftovers.
Uh-huh.
And Jeremy Irons is in that as well, playing one of the leads. So, yeah, interesting little tie-in.
Very interesting.
And then the plot... From my very short reading on Wikipedia is that the film follows this is a quote from Wikipedia, the film follows the fragmented and nightmarish events surrounding a Hollywood actress, Laura Dern, who begins to take on the personality of a character she plays in a film, which is, I guess, interesting in the context of Masks on Masks.
Mm.
Like, where does that character end and the other one begin?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's all I could really glean from it without going and watching what I'm sure is a truly true atrocity of a David Lynch film.
Yeah.
As they all
I know
are.
I know how you feel about yeah. David, our man, David Lynch. I'm curious cause the way Lindelof answered the, like, cause he asked a question about like, you know, Lady True and this relationship with Will and Angela. And he implied that maybe that would be cleared up in this next episode. He said, there's he said that's like next episode. And then when, the guy was asking him other questions. He kept on saying finale, finale, finale. But like, I think we might get some substantive answers to some of these things raised, which would fit the mold of like this PD file stuff, raising questions yeah. and having us thinking about stuff that will be addressed in the next episode. So I'm kind mm-hmm. of expecting that we might, I'm not going to be disappointed if we don't, but I am actually kind of expecting that we'll get some answers along those lines this next episode.
Yeah.
Shall we get to feedback?
Let's do it.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and bald move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
You can send feedback to Watchmen at baldmove.com, or you can discuss with your fellow fans each week's episode on forums.baldmove.com. First up is Josh. He says, today's instant cast, you mentioned how the Klan hypnosis idea was too far out of actual race history in the U.S., but I got to disagree. Racists have always used mass media heavily to sway public opinion. The idea that people of color are more violent, something that you see thrown around on Fox News today, or somehow less intelligent began as depictions in films and television over 100 years ago. One of the first ever blockbuster films was Birth of a Nation. We talked about this a bit, but like not in depth, so I thought this was a good counterpart to our discussion. This is a film about how the Klan would save America from white women-obsessed black men. Sure, it's not as direct as having a subliminal message commanding black people to attack one another, but it's in the same lane. The events in Dr. Strangelove are pretty far-fetched, but they serve a purpose to show the insanity of mutually assured destruction as a form of satire. The way that media manipulation is portrayed in Watchmen is over the top, but the point is to make the connection crystal clear. The media, controlled by people with ill intent, have shaped the minds and attitudes of and about people of color. The audiences may not riot in theaters like they did in the show, but they do ingest this content and use that information, knowingly or otherwise, to form opinions of communities they do not know or understand. After Birth of a Nation was released, there's a marked increase in the people signing up to join the Klan because people believe what they see in the media. Take the American hero story we saw within the world of Watchmen. The entire history of Hooded Justice has been whitewashed, and his crusade against racism was co-opted and repackaged to sell banking by Captain Metropolis. The idea that advertising exists proves that people form opinions on things by their depiction in the media. It's why everyone's having such a great time drinking in the Bud Light Lime commercials, because no one's an addict in beer commercials. Now, Will using it on Jed, maybe a bit much for me, but I think the point was to show how the message can be hijacked and used against those who have traditionally wielded it. But I'll admit I'm stretching a bit to fit in this into the metaphor.
Not that much.
Yeah.
Not that much.
Like I said, it would not surprise me to learn that there's a little bit of fibs being told in these final memories. And I don't know. Like I felt very strong on Sunday that there would be another reveal that was actually the Judd, you know, that Will remains improbably strong enough to best, you know, especially if it has the element of surprise, this Judd in single combat. But I'm warming up to the idea that this is just a commentary on media.
Yeah.
And that was a really good breakdown for us there, Josh. Moving on to Matt. I enjoyed this episode for the most part, but there's a few things that were head-scratchers to me. I wish they'd set up Will as more of a badass before he put on the hood. Also, Hooded Justice was supposed to be a big, burly, incredibly strong man. So where was that when the cops lynched him? The actor was fine in the role, but not physically what I think the role called for. I mean... this is the classic Batman story. Like Batman, when he first went out to fight crime, got his ass kicked because he's just one dude. You know, there was no mystique. There was no terror. There was no element of this theatrics as what Ra's al Ghul called it. And I think you're supposed to understand that, like, you know, Will, maybe as big and strong as he is, he's just one dude. And against people with badges and guns, he is, you know, that's a strong person's kryptonite. Mm-hmm. So it worked for me. And I also think this guy actually had some beef on his frame. I was shocked to find out this was the kid that just 3 years ago played like this teenager in The Leftovers. So like, maybe that's what it's like, the fact that this guy had filled out and, you know, had a lot of beef on his frame sold it for me. But I don't know. Real life strong guys don't like look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. They're more like, you know, like beefy and just kind of big all around than like lean and cut, you know?
Right.
Matt continues, the scene where his wife flips out when he's washing the makeup off his son and he's wearing his father's costume. There would never be any context that a black parent or really any parent would be fine with a child that put a noose around his neck. And B, Will didn't shove his face under the faucet and scrub it with a Brillo pad. I just feel like the scene wasn't portrayed perhaps aggressively enough to warrant the wife's anger, telling him that he needs to go back to Oklahoma.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of built-in history there. Yeah. Like, this is like a final straw moment.
Yeah.
You're right. They didn't show us a lot of the buildup.
But she's seen the buildup in other places in his life and where it goes. And, like, she's not going to wait around to see, oh, this is step A of his anger cycle. And she's tapping out at the first sign.
Yeah.
But I can see what you're saying about that, too. But it also just really ties into his father's reaction to him putting on his uniform. And expressing some mixed feelings that his son looked like he was going to follow in his footsteps, but for different reasons, you know. Davin writes, why did Will Reese's wife want to go back to Tulsa so bad? She didn't grow up there, and neither did he, and their history with Black Wall Street should have wanted them to keep them far away. Got any ideas on that?
I mean, she calls it home, right? I mean, I guess she views the place of her birth as home.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's enough to explain it in my mind.
Yeah. And also, like, I'm guessing that Will didn't just move to New York as soon as he was, like, 8 years old or whatever. That they might have settled down in an area nearby. There might have been some family. Like, did he know his parents' friends well enough to know their last names? Could they find family? Like, are you supposed to understand that Will got adopted and this, I can't remember Will's wife's name. Will's wife got adopted by a family in the same way that, like, Angela's adopted these slain officers' children. Like, there's a lot of we don't know enough yet.
Right.
But it's not hard for me to believe that they spent some time in Tulsa before going to New York for him to become a cop. Sonny, I love all the technology in the show and the different regulations, like some of the cell phone technology. My question is, what tech in our world do you guys think the government could be regulating, if any?
Could be regulating?
Yeah, like I'm not sure
because we would know about
could
it.
Could or they're trying to ask could or should.
Oh, well, I think it's implied they're secretly regulating it somehow, which you can't do. Hmm. You can hide a tech. Mm-hmm. Can't regulate it without us knowing.
Well, I mean, if there's like, I mean, I this is kind of like the Edward Snowden, you know, NSA spying, the fact that they're running the systems that essentially process all of our emails and voicemails. And but I was thinking like maybe it's like more of a should than a could. And if that's the case, then I think, you know,
we're about to have a big battle on facial ID face ID systems.
Oh, yeah. You're right, because that's like the end game of privacy.
Yeah.
Which I think
we'll lose that one.
I think we're going to lose all the privacy. Tech, yeah. We're like my hope is that like we turn these tools both directions, so it's not just used against the powerless, but we can use it also to get transparency on the powerful, and maybe that'll be an overall good thing. But yeah, that and social media. I mean, that's the two things I think are going to be fights for our generation. You know, like we have. Yeah. It's weird to like, but well, it's not weird. We have laws against like what you can say on TV. Like you can't just say toothpaste is going to cure cancer. You can't commit interstate mail fraud. There's a lot of things you can't do with communication devices, and social media is this wild west because they pretend to be like this thing where everyone's just connected together. You know, we're not doing a responsibility for any of the stuff that goes on. And yet we also see, you know, moneyed influences kind of setting the conversations on those sites. So
I mean, I think it's partially an enforcement problem.
Uh-huh.
Like, how the fuck do you police the social internet? We haven't figured that out yet. And B, it's also this weird, this strange adaptation of like corporations are people in some senses, but they're not in others. And so when a corporation gets on television and spouts a whole bunch of bullshit, they can be held accountable for that. But when they do it on social media, where that's perceived as more like a personal kind of connection,
they can
get away with it somehow.
Right.
But yeah, I think those two problems are going to be not completely solved, but worked on over the next few years.
Hopefully. Yeah. Because otherwise you'll end up with secret regulations like Sonny's fearing here. Ian, I've really enjoyed the show and how it's paralleled the comic with major events. They seem to be telling the same story as the comic, but with completely new characters and a new time period. Each episode seems to have an event that's a direct callback to the comic that falls in line with the timeline of the comic. In the first episode, obviously, there's the death of Judd, which parallels the death of the comedian. The second episode, we get to play see Veidt putting on the play. At the same time, we got the origin story of Dr. Manhattan in the comic. In the third episode, after the car falls out of the sky, we get a shot of Laurie looking up at the Mars, standing out distinctively in the sky, which is damn near identical to the comic panel of Dr. Manhattan doing the same thing before he goes to Mars in the comic. We also get a fake assassination attempt upon a man who's trying to orchestrate a major hoax. And the fifth episode comes with a similar point in the storyline where we get to see Rorschach's background in the comic as well. The newest episode plays with time and memories in a very similar fashion as to when John takes Laurie to Mars and shows her how he perceives time. In both cases, it tells the person experiencing the memories something about where they came from as well. I'm sure there's many more examples, but it seems like a masterful bit of storytelling to tell a completely new story in a format of an existing one. Given all that, what do you think we can guess about the upcoming episodes? Maybe there'll be a prison break or a break out of some sort of institution.
I mean, Ozzy's leading up to that, right?
Oh, yeah. Kinda. You're right. There's that. There's obviously a giant squid attack. The other thing missing is like a romance, an unlikely romance subplot.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that could be. Because, you know, Angela's got the super hot boyfriend or husband that is often remarked upon by Laurie. And, like, is there going to be kind of like a sweet them coming together after all this? I don't know. Because, like, I wonder what he's going to say to her after she comes to. Because we already know he's been kind of chafing from all these lies and all these half truths that he's had, and now she's done this thing and put their lives in jeopardy and her own life in jeopardy. I wonder.
Need to sit them down at LG's desk and have them give a frank conversation. Just Angela and Cal just talking things over with Lori listening in through the cactus.
Through the cactophone. Yep. Any other ideas about where we might be heading?
Nah, I didn't get to the end of the comic books, so I really only have the movie knowledge to go on.
Right. Well, then Dr. Manhattan will attack in the final episode.
I mean, a master
obviously.
Plan, right? Like, or the unveiling of a master plan that's probably already been accomplished before the heroes get there. That kind of thing.
Latrice, is the affair with Captain Metropolis something from the comics and or movies? To me, it was startling and irrelevant to the plot other than to show that Will picked the convenient wife. As always, thanks for your input. It was hinted. It was something that was like, it was always discussed in those in-universe clips of like the Night Owl's memoirs that they had a gay relationship, but it wasn't like an important part of the comics. It was just there for kind of the like rumor and innuendo and the salaciousness that would get something printed. I'm not really sure why they chose that bit of the fiction to bring into it. Although I guess I could see if I'm a gay fan or a bisexual fan of The Watchmen and they revealed all that was just horseshit, like that maybe that would feel like erasing the aspect of his character. So
could be. Yeah.
I don't know. Mad Max, at the very beginning of the episode, the show makes a point of having Laurie explain to Angela how nostalgia works and how it's made. However, the final memory of Will with Judd at the hanging tree occurred just before Will called Angela, so there's no time to make a hanging tree nostalgia pill. That means the pill was likely made after Will was abducted and then taken back to Lady True's facility, which also means it was purposely put into Will's pill bottle and the pill bottle put back in Angela's glove compartment for Angela to find. What would be the point of making this memory pill and leaving for it for Angela? And how would Will know Angela would take the pills? Could it suggest a hanging tree memory was intentionally altered and is a false memory? Or is it just possible the showrunners slash writers overlooked a plot hole surrounding the timing of the memory? I mean, it's not a problem for timing. We know Will was abducted right from with the pill bottle, and then the pill bottle appeared 24 hours later, and he's abducted by Lady True, who has all this technology. But the question is, why this memory? And I think it's pretty clear, like, he wanted Angela to know without a doubt that he's the one that killed Judd, and that he knew Judd was a racist, and he knew, like in a way that Angela didn't, how these people can operate and pretend like they're your friends and then betray behind their back.
Right.
So that's what I'm thinking. But it's like also like I'm also kind of half floated the idea that I think this memory is false somehow too. It is curious that this is the only memory in like a 50-year gap that he saw fit to fill her in on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a lot of great ideas. What about you?
No, I mean, the opportunity is certainly there for the switcheroo. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't take any of these pills until after the pills have left her side mm-hmm. and returned. So
how do Will know that she would? See, here's the other thing is like, I don't know that Will intended her to take it. Like, I think that there was events set in place that would make her curious enough that she would have to take it, but this is a very long fucking game.
Mm-hmm.
And then like
very passive aggressive, as
and then
Laura
and Looking Glass kind of hit the gas when they betrayed her. So it's like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a risky plan.
Also, Will has mind control technology. Mm-hmm. So like, is this a blended thing where, like, we talked about the significance of someone like serving you voluntarily because they or allying with you voluntarily because they understand your goals and they share them, versus a forced coerced mm-hmm. forced conversion is what I'm trying to say. What if it's like a double reverse twist betrayal? Like, he uses the flashlight device to incept the idea that she needs to take the pills, so she takes the pills and thinks that she is sympathetic to her grandpa because she made these organic decisions herself. I could see them playing something along those lines. That, you
has
know,
Angela seen any flashing lights lately?
I honestly don't know. I would have to.
I don't think so.
But would you, like, she could have seen, like, a movie or some kind of projector. Oh, that's the one thing we didn't, the lead we buried in the Lady True article. I can't believe we almost forgot this. Lady True has bought everyone brand new state-of-the-art HDTV screens for everyone within an X amount of radius around the tower.
Right.
To compensate them for the inconvenience her construction has caused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's whatever the empathy, but that's it. That is what that we now see the bomb mm-hmm. and how it's going to work and its mechanism of action, but we don't know the payload. That's the thing.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's no fucking way that those things are not specially designed to brainwash the fuck out of a whole bunch of people
mm-hmm.
in much the same way that we saw the War of the Worlds stuff play out. Like, yeah, it's gotta be. Anything else, or should we wrap this thing up?
No, I think I'm ready to wrap it up.
All right, we're going to send this into a space capsule and blast it off to this destroyed world that is this podcast into next week's hopeful new era of the show, I guess. I don't know. I've lost my own metaphor. Long of the short and the thick and the wide of it is send the feedback in to AssRipper at Bald... no, to Watchmen at BaldMove.com. And we will consider it. You can also, of course, get in contact with your fellow fans, your fellow Watchmen and Watchwomen at forums.baldmove.com.
Yeah, I don't want any emails coming into my personal address.
Yeah?
No, thank you.
Yeah, you know, that's your Tinder profile. It's a sensitive right. account. So, yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to come back on Sunday night, of course, with the Instant Talk and Instant Take podcast, where we'll have our off-the-cuff conversation with y'all. And we'll be back next Tuesday for another full run of the next episode, Episode 7 of Watchmen. Only 3 left.
Yeah.
Answer soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.